Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is Friday the 13th of January 2023. And this is episode 362. I'm the ghost, Mark Ames. I am in Rochester, New York. And I'm online with the War Nerd, Gary Bretscher, about to say a farewell, bid adieu to Trieste. John, how you doing?
Well, yeah, our last night in Trieste. I'm a little sad about that.
Yeah. Oh, it's your last night, actually. Okay.
Yeah, we're leaving
Friday the 13th.
We're walking to the train station at 5 a.m. tomorrow in our inimitable style. And so, yeah, it's like my last 9 hours in Trieste. Kind of sad. I as I've said many times, I like Trieste more than any city I've inhabited in a long time. But I want to introduce our guest here.
Yes.
I thought I'd try it this time, even though Mark generally does such a great job, because our guest and I go back a long way. We were comrades together in the trenches of the reading and composition program in the rhetoric department at Berkeley. And we've known each other for a very long time. And I'm talking, of course, about the superb critic, superb prose stylist, film historian Eileen Jones, now film critic for Jacobin. And Eileen has been incredibly productive for a long, long time. But she's been knocking out great reviews, sometimes two a week, to the shame of the rest of us. So if you haven't seen those reviews in Jacobin, read them now. We're going to be talking about some of them, because this is actually part of our Civil War series. Eileen, as she says in one of her reviews, has been a lifelong Civil War fan herself. And she's going to talk about the really strange topic that we wanted to get into for a long time: Civil War movies. The stuff they do, and almost more interesting, the odd amount of stuff about the Civil War that they don't do and probably can't do. So Eileen, thanks very much. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You overwhelm me with praise, which is what I live for. So glad to be here.
Good. Now that we got you all buttered up, first of all, how is it there in Buffalo? Because we just finally got here in Rochester, which is, you know, just an hour's drive. We finally got our first little dusting of snow today.
Yeah, we did as well.
And the kids were excited. Yeah, you did as well. But you guys got, I'm saying we haven't had any this year. I think we had
Oh, you never got the apocalyptic?
No. That big storm that hit.
Oh.
It was like we had giant fans blowing everything your way. We got nothing. Nada.
Oh, somehow I did not realize that at all.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It was awful.
We got maybe an inch or two, and then it went away after a few days. We had the cold and the wind, but you guys had
everything.
It was like, you know, the scene of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, when like everything is totally frozen over and stuff.
Yes. Yes, and people were just dying at an incredible rate, and it was terrifying. I mean, the possibility of freezing to death in your own house became like a real thing for all of us.
I saw those photos of like houses looking like, I don't know, it looked like some demon force, you know, from like blanketed them in ice so that they were almost like stone or something.
All those crazy, and the crazy patterns the ice made. No, exactly. It's like those houses in Charles Birchfield paintings that John introduced me to. He's a local artist from around here from many years ago. And he makes these houses in winter that look like they're screaming either because they're demonic themselves or being attacked by demons. And it was really like that. It was terrifying. The whole thing was terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear it. So you guys definitely got the brunt of it. So you have plenty of snowpack out there still.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, actually, I don't. It's finally come down to just ridges of ice. But for a long time, it just seemed like it was not going to go away. But then we got such bizarre warm weather.
Yeah.
So it's been crazy weather. Yeah.
Yes. You know. Same here. I mean, we've had really warm weather here. It's yeah. And then rain. It's just weird anyway.
Everything's yeah. just weird and it's going to stay weird.
I know, huh?
Well, I think Schopenhauer summed it up best for the extreme depressives when he said that aging and life in general is a process in which you have to say to yourself, this is bad and it's going to get worse mm. until it comes to the worst of all. Mm. And it probably sounds cheerier in German, but it's pretty German good.
Really bowled them over in Nuremberg yeah. or something. But, yeah, so let's go to a cheerier time, which mm. is not our time, the Civil War era. Mm. Well, and then I guess depictions, Hollywood's depictions of the Civil War, mm. which is very important. And I don't know how you want to start this off, Eileen. I mean, we were talking a little bit.
Well,
before the show.
I wanted to mm. review a simple question, like yeah. Okay. That I think you mentioned in your article, not so much a review as an article, an overview mm-hmm. of Civil War movies. I want to see if I've got this right. There were, I think you said, mm-hmm. 457 movies at the time mm-hmm. you wrote about the Civil War. Is that mm-hmm. right?
That was listed by a scholar. I forget what year he was writing. Right. And he was trying to come up with tabulations of percentages
right.
Of what movies favored the South, what favored the North, what were neutral, that kind of thing. So I think that is the number he threw out there. I don't know how right that is. But the fascinating aspect of that was he was claiming a larger percentage of films were pro-North than anything I could find.
Yeah, mm. I found that odd too. This is John, I don't know how you pronounce it, Kuiper?
Kuiper, right. Kuiper? I don't know, yeah.
I'll just say John Cooper. Mm-hmm. And you cite this article or book, a quantitative description of a genre says 457 Civil War films between 1897 mm. and 1961. Oh, so there's probably many, many hundreds
many more
now.
After. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he claimed, and I agree, this is odd. It doesn't match my own memory. 29%, almost a third, are what he called Northern orientation, which I guess is pro-North.
Mm-hmm.
And 42% more, that is, are pro-Southern. But I would have said mm-hmm. the disparity is much bigger.
Yeah.
Well, that's absolutely the main take of my research is in the article.
Yeah.
Was I couldn't believe how I just couldn't find almost yep. any pro-Northern, pro-abolition, pro-Union, anything to do with the North. Almost impossible to find films that took that stance. You know, there is a stipulation, a kind of a weird one, saying any film set in the North was considered a pro-North
right.
film.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I have a feeling that, yeah, the way he decided what pro-North meant
right,
is
meant.
Something that would be highly debatable. Yeah.
But the big find, that the research that I did, and I read several books and a lot of articles, is that there's the cache of truly pro-Northern, pro-Union, pro-abolition, films were made in the early silent era.
Right,
right.
From
that's
up
amazing.
To 09.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're the least likely films any of us would ever see. They're either most likely to be lost altogether, like the majority of silent films, or they're in archives. And who watches, you know, 1908 films other than
right.
someone doing yeah. the research? So that really helps at least explain something.
I think it's so interesting that early on, okay, mm. Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1903 yeah. was a hit, mm-hmm. but that spurred on some more pro-Union ones, which you'd expect because it's still people are alive at that time who were in the Civil War mm-hmm. and or like were kids of veterans of the Civil War. But that they made a movie that quickly, Escape from Andersonville, which is, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like Escape from, you know, Sobibor, Auschwitz right. or something, right? Mm-hmm. And so that showed that, I mean, that's what you would expect from the victorious, mm-hmm. From the victorious side, movies like Escape from Andersonville. And mm-hmm. instead, literally, like, that movie put a stop to it, and then you get Birth of a Nation instead. It's kind of amazing. Like,
yeah, well, I think there's a lot obviously going on there, and there mm-hmm. are various ways of explaining it. But the one I know best from dealing with histories of the Civil War mm-hmm. and literature about the Civil War is that the Lost Cause myth took a while to get going. Much like, come to think of it, the Lost Cause myth about Vietnam. I mean, as we've said on Radio Warner many times, I remember the 70s. I'm old enough to do that. And the U.S. finally fled Saigon in 1975. And in the movies showing heroic, doomed Americans didn't really start coming until 1980, especially with Deer Hunter, which I think was very early 80s. And that was when it became romantic. Before that, it was totally uncool, which was historically accurate. It was not a pleasant war, if there is such a thing. And in popular imagination, like it or not, there is. And that wasn't one. But after a while, they came up with a Lost Cause myth. And the Lost Cause in Vietnam was, we were fighting with one hand to hide behind our back, which was an utter lie. And the Lost Cause myth about the Civil War, of course, is that it was a noble cause, that it was determined by an endless number of foreign mercenaries against a noble but outnumbered people. All that whole lie didn't gain any traction for at least a decade. And as late as 1879, John Logan, who was a great polemicist, I did a newsletter about this, was still arguing, don't do this. The planters want to regain control and they mean to do it. I mean, he understood that. Nobody listened to him. And thus, I mean, I think in literature too, in histories, the 20th century came in very nastily when it came to the Civil War. And it got worse during the World War I or Woodrow Wilson era. Wilson is one of those people you end up not liking at all. I remember thinking of him as one of the better emperors of the pantheon, you know, and that's not really true in a lot of ways.
He's a nasty figure. He had some good progressive policies, but I mean, you know, I ditched all of that to just ditch the whole fucking thing. He was awful.
There's also the thing I've always wondered about and wanted to read more about was with the rollout success of the Lost Cause narrative that ultimately is just unbelievably successful across the nation. How patchy was it? Like, were there regions where it wasn't taking? I would have thought New England, the stronghold of abolitionism with a glorious history in the Civil War, would have resisted more. And, you know, there is a kind of argument that you would have had more pro-Northern films in that era because the film company, all the major film studios were still in the Northeast. They were right around New York, New Jersey. And it was as they started chasing good weather, first in Florida and then in California, that you start getting this drift along with a greater and greater acceptance of Lost Cause stuff toward everything's got to be either pro-South or at least pro-unity, and the war was this kind of horrible, regrettable thing that everybody went through together. And
well, tragedy, that's the thing that just gets me. It's like the way that they kind of the Lost Cause fits neatly with the idea that it was a tragedy. We don't look at World War II as a tragedy. There was good guys and bad guys. And, and you know, the Civil War is very clearly good guys and bad guys. Right. Now, there may have been people within it. I don't know who you might find a way to sympathize, but like the cause, there was a good cause and a bad cause by any goddamn standard. But it's not. It's just portrayed. And they still keep pushing that nearly all the time, the tragedy, the tragic element. And when you make it a tragedy, that means you have, you know, profound, deep empathy for both sides and whatever the cause is.
You want to. There's a constant attempt, unless you're blaming the North, the War of Northern Aggression, just taking that. There's a just over and over the attempt to just obscure how the war ever started. You always skip Fort Sumter.
Yes,
I didn't realize that had become a rule, but it was a rule.
Yeah. It was a rule? Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah, you just didn't depict Fort Sumter. Because
really? Where did these rules? Where did they come from?
The studios, more and more, but everyone reports this, that there were such vociferous complaints from the South about we don't like seeing the South represented as the losers, even though, and, you know, the appeasement of the South has always been huge, which in a way I don't even understand. Surely the population isn't so great that that's your cherished, you know, your cherished area of the country. And yet our whole nation's history seems to be about appeasing the South. So the studios just seem to have gotten on board. But I think the argument goes, they found they could sell a romanticized image of the South to the North and the West too.
Yep. Yep.
Because so, I think the North, especially the West, having grown up in California, I grew up in a place where there were Peanuts cartoons, as I've said, showing Linus in either blue or gray cap for the centennial of the Civil War, and Charlie Brown in the other side's cap. And but it wasn't really a balance. It was the white South that cared very, very deeply in a silent, resentful way. Not everybody, but a lot of them, and the North that had gone on to the making of money and had absorbed immigrants who had not grown up with those family stories about what happened to our uncle. Whereas the South, I think because it lived in a bitter stagnation after the war, that very profitable for some people, but not particularly economically thriving, the kind of world that Faulkner describes, it didn't get a lot of immigrants and didn't like the ones it got for the most part. The North, meanwhile, was having waves and waves of immigrants from everywhere in the old world, as they called it then, in the early 20th century, and was also getting very, very rich. And I don't think they cared very much. So it was a lot simpler to appease the people who, the white South basically, who did care very deeply.
Right.
And it made for easier movies too. But this tradition of appeasement goes way, way back to 1865 itself. Well, it goes back to—
goes back well before that.
It goes all the way back
and probably further. But, I mean, even at their lowest point, the Southern elite was continuing a tradition of arrogance such that at one point when— William Tecumseh Sherman himself, who was trying to arrange a surrender of troops in the lower South because Grant was handling it up in Virginia. He was in the Carolinas. And these people who had been utterly defeated, largely thanks to Sherman, were so demanding at these talks that Sherman finally had to say, "See here, gentlemen, who is doing the surrendering today?"
Wow. Yeah. You know, look at it from a different side. What if they put out movie after movie about, about what it was fought over, which was slavery and to free this, basically to end slavery versus protecting slavery, where blacks would have to be really the good guys and blacks would have to be the, the people you sympathize with.
Right.
And how dangerous that could have been. And that might have, how potentially dangerous that would be to, middle and upper middle class white Americans at that time in the South, but also in the North.
Right, and if racism really necessitates you sidelining the whole narrative of slavery and the black experience, it's so much easier to go with this other narrative, with the Birth of a Nation's narrative, where what's being threatened here are the white brothers of the North and the South are being divided and imperiled by the rise of a black empire.
And
that's a line, even if you have to bury it a bit, that goes right on from Birth of a Nation. That's how you get the tragedy narrative.
Mm-hmm. So Birth of a Nation, if I recall right, came out in 1915, right?
Because, the 50-year anniversary.
Yeah. Right, is that right? 15 or 16? Yes, yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
The Wilson era. Mm-hmm. Very nasty era. America was,
Wilson was a segregationist. I mean, I think he upped segregation in Washington, D.C., but he was a pro-segregationist, mm-hmm. Democrat. Yeah.
Which often gets lost if you're studying the progressive era and you think, we were making such great strides there, but it's a tricky era.
Yes.
But it was such a film phenomenon. If you study film history, you must reckon with Birth of a Nation, which of course gets worse all the time. Yeah. I was shown it. I was probably the last generation of film students to be shown it in a very bland way. They would still just show it to you without context. Now I almost wish I can't do that.
I don't know. Maybe I seeing it at this age after everything, I don't really usually get overly shocked by movies. I watched it last night and it's surprisingly well done the only silent movies I'm mostly familiar with are Charlie Chaplin movies, and there are little things and I just kind of expect those really funny looking hoppity people there. So it's very well done, but the movie made me sick to my, physically sick. It is such just straight up fascist lies. Yes. I knew it wasn't like I thought, oh, Birth of a Nation, this might be very, progressive or might not. I already knew that it was a pro-Klan movie and it says so right in the beginning, you know. Damn, it sickened me on two levels. One was the obvious, the lies about slavery and who started the war and so on. The other thing is you're supposed to, and this is a common theme, well, certainly like Gone with the Wind, so on. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to somehow not just not be sickened by, but be totally enamored of these vile, really rich. They're like, I don't know, the French aristocracy before the guillotines came in and took care of them. Like, they're so horrible and disgusting. Mm-hmm. Their lives are like, You just think, I'm going to become a fucking Bolshevik. Like, this movie is going to make me a Bolshevik and just kill them all. And yet, that's where I just don't understand people. Like, who watches that and thinks, oh, those were the days. That was such. It's not even that they're. It's not even the slavery necessary. It's more like the costumes, the letter writing, the big hairdos.
The dances.
The dances, exactly. It's just endless costume balls.
Yeah.
I admit I've only seen clips of Birth of a Nation. I gather the whole thing is more than 3 hours long.
I know it is.
It's long, hard to imagine seeing one of those, as Mark puts it, hoppity movies for 3 hours. But I do know that, as you, much younger than me, Eileen, were one of the last generation to be taken to certain films as a school group. Mm-hmm. My English class in high school, around 1972, maybe, was dragged to a Century 21 theater to see Gone with the Wind. And I never quite figured out why, but then a lot of films that were considered to be part of the American curriculum were not as self-evidently canonical or for such self-evident reasons as whoever assigned them thought, because I couldn't see, as a Civil War fan, what Gone with the Wind told anybody about the Civil War.
I know. Were you puzzled? Do you remember what they talked about, John?
Yeah.
Like, after the movie?
No, honestly, I remember a lot of fancy dresses and scenes.
No, but I mean your teacher or anything. Like, what was supposed to be the takeaway from watching it? Or was there just like,
you gave the teacher Mrs. some time Crabapple off? Apple smoking in the back of the room.
Yeah. Okay.
that was their takeaway.
She was like, I can get rid of 3.5 hours this way.
Well, it's so awkward for film history that the two perhaps most phenomenal films in Hollywood history, at least if you take us up to the end of the studio era, are Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. Both just insane levels of success. Birth of a Nation, the more important one, just historically. Mm-hmm. It's the reason you say it's good. It's because it's D.W. Griffith, and infuriatingly, he's a great filmmaker.
Yeah.
So having to negotiate, he's a great filmmaker, and he's just ideologically, he's a total monster. He was a total pro.
I don't know anything about him.
Pro Southern aristocrat all the way, even though he was poor, but he was poor Southern. But he worshipped the Confederacy. That was the whole nine yards. So he brought all this gushing, you know, love and reverence to the subject, but he's so damn skilled. I mean, speaking of Bolsheviks, the Russians were just taking chapter and verse D.W. Griffith because, as they said, he's the only American who can edit. He's the only one. And they weren't wrong. So the battle, there are a couple of battle scenes that are still beautiful.
This around this time I had to turn it off because it just made me so sick. But it was done so well about an hour in, where there's this Southern mother sort of like cuddling, like protecting her three poor, bedraggled children, Southern children, high up on a hill, hiding in like bushes and grass. And down below you see this, basically, they're depicted as like the Nazi hordes or something, which is the Union Army sweeping
swarming
through below.
Swarming. Absolutely.
And they're just up there vulnerable and doomed and, the
Did
mother
you see
the
little colonel's charge when he leaves his bedraggled men? They run across the field, totally outnumbered, of course, but brave beyond belief. And he spikes a cannon with the Confederate flag himself.
Wow. I didn't see that.
It's very beautifully shot.
Wow. Okay.
But at every level, the film is twisted and evil. Guess how they portray Thaddeus Stevens.
That was the most shocking thing. Thaddeus Stevens is one of the most heroic figures.
Yeah.
I mean, there's John Brown, but for obvious reasons, pacifists aren't big fans. But Thaddeus Stevens never did any violence in his life, and he gave his life to pushing justice. It's pretty much that simple. And he did it at great cost.
He comes off so bad in this movie.
They made him into a monster.
Oh, he's a monster. He's gimping because, the club foot is known and the wig, the bad wig are known.
Yeah.
So they use those to make him this physically twisted little gargoyle. And he's in love and sexually enthralled to his mulatto. I'm using quote unquote the old term word for mixed race. Mistress, which of course is slandering his actual maybe she was his housekeeper. I forget her name now.
Right.
I had it in. It's in the article. Anyway.
Yeah. And she's depicted as a freak too.
Oh,
and
a total freak. I mean, just like, what is she
just
even
the
doing?
Whole thing's so horrible. Yeah.
She writhes all the time. Is
faking that
sexual
she's getting raped
frenzy?
and then turning him on with her stories of being raped and he wants to rape. It's so
Lydia
weird.
Hamilton Smith, his
That's it.
Housekeeper. Yes. Mentioned in your novel, as you say. Well, one thing that I wonder about and that I wanted to ask you about, Eileen, is, I mean, there's one thing that has to be acknowledged, that the planters could summon a lot of other much poorer Southern whites who were, and then this has certain echoes, voting some and fighting against their own interests, though occasionally they realized otherwise. And that made them scary. And there was a lot of fear, just plain old fear of those people. And if you didn't really care very much about black people, well, why not? You know, why not buy their allegiance to the American project by letting them have what struck most Northern white Americans as maybe an odd but irrelevant myth. I mean, you're not really supposed to care that much about history anyway in mainstream American culture. And these things especially seem to appear when you need not just acceptance, but enthusiastic acceptance of the American project. Like, as I recall, Gone with the Wind appeared in 1939. And this horrible film with Andrew Johnson, that swine.
Tennessee Johnson.
as the hero. And Thaddeus Stevens as
the villain.
The monster came out in 1942. Mm-hmm. Which right, so it would have been made just as the U.S. was facing the fact that it was going to have to go into the big one.
Right.
So they needed that demographic, and maybe they paid them off more at that point.
No, one of the shocking things about reading about how, you know, the craziness of the narrative has a period of intensification, and it's crazy as you head into World War II and fight the war, is because unity above all, at least unity among certain groups, becomes the watchword, but their version of trying to do it is things like this completely twisted celebration of Andrew Johnson in this movie where Thaddeus Stevens is evil because he's trying to get him impeached, of course. And it's because they could sell Johnson to the region of the South. Yeah, they need these people. But their version of appeasing, they also, during the war, there were, again, rules were sort of sent down from the government saying, we've got to stop with the more virulent aspects of racism because we now have people of color serving with distinction in the armed services. And again, unity, unity, unity. So they would, if you read the histories of some of these films, they would actually be taking out the worst. But they're leaving in things that you're like, really? That wasn't considered the worst? So they would take out the most vile things. Like Gone with the Wind is a good example. You watch Gone with the Wind and you can't believe they worked really hard to remove all the most insultingly racist stuff because you're like, what? So there's
what did they take out?
Oh, the characters are members of the Klan when there's a scene, you've seen it, where they go to avenge the attack on Scarlett O'Hara and they're going to clean out the quote unquote shanty town.
She's in that carriage and her driver has to.
Yes,
whip
and you notice there's a black man and a black attacker and a white attacker. So it's supposed to be poor whites gone wrong and freed slaves. So it's the Ashley Wilkes, Rhett Butler, and all these other people go to clean it out, and it's a Klan thing. Ashley's a member of the Klan, but so that can't be shown, and they certainly can't have robes. You know, they can't have.
Were they originally filmed in the classic Klan robes?
No, they never were.
Oh,
because,
okay.
Weirdly enough, for all of its huge success and influence, Birth of a Nation was an enormously controversial film. I mean, the NAACP mounted enormous protests. It really was very controversial. And a lesson was learned. Like, we don't want to go quite that controversial.
That is another interesting point of this article of yours. And I think I'd better mention the title again.
The Cinematic Lost Cause, right?
By Eileen Jones in Jacobin. Mm-hmm. You said this in the article, and I was pleasantly surprised for once, which is, the NAACP had the power, even in 1915, to gather big demonstrations actually had an effect.
That had some sort of an effect. And again, because it's not like it's for noble reasons. There is a big appeasing quality of the Hollywood studio system. Whenever they possibly could, they would avoid the worst, most controversial stuff if it was easy to do. But it's literally like removing a couple of words here or there, or taking the actual robes away, or not shooting the scene directly, but referring to it. Things like that. So you're reading these just tiny, tiny concessions, but nevertheless, there was a kind, especially as you're moving toward war, and more and more, the government is saying we don't want the more vitriolic, horrible stuff. You've got to tamp it down a little bit. So they were by the standards of the day. But then you watch Gone with the Wind, and you're like, really? This is the tamped down, iced up, smoothed over version.
Yeah. Well, I think now that I think of it, I mean, I'm sure you know all this better than I do, but offhand, I can only remember one scene. Is there a battle beside the only soldier that I can remember being killed in that movie is the would-be rapist who gets shot on the stairs.
Yeah. A sort of deserter from Sherman's army who's...
bummer in Sherman's terms. Yeah. You know,
who's menacing Scarlett O'Hara, yes.
Yeah, a forager.
Right. Yeah.
The question of whether there were mass rapes or a lot of rapes, by the way, against civilian women during Sherman's march when a lot of soldiers were dispersed to forage, as they called it, something of a euphemism, in the countryside, has a kind of awful answer, as far as I can tell. They tended to rape enslaved women. I think there were very few cases, at least, proved of raping white women in the South, but they many times raped enslaved women and girls. But we're talking about Victorian Anglos, so it was actually a very difficult question to mention at all. You had to somehow arouse, if you were a lost cause activist, you had to arouse rage, and I mean very deep rage, without saying anything explicit. And that led to all kinds of elaborate euphemisms and also to not having any very good information about what, when, who, and how many.
Yeah, there's a little more in the book, the constant terror of it, though I don't think there are any depictions. But look at Birth of a Nation. There's a whole storyline where rape is just the constant rampaging blackmail. There's a character devoted to that. I forget his name in the narrative. And doesn't he drive the one of the young Southern family, the Southern planter family women, right off a cliff? I'm trying to remember if she jumps.
I didn't get that
something.
Far, like I said, but I was in the part where they're led sort of wild by a Union, you know, a bad Northerner, and the women are like chased. Basically, they have to hide down in a basement, terrified from these from blacks with guns running around their house, just breaking things. And for and women.
Yes, with the first thing they're going to do is go for the white women. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's all very much softened. And then the attack on Scarlett O'Hara is a romantic fainting image of Scarlett O'Hara. And I believe it's the white man leaning over her.
The soldier she kills is definitely white.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. He's definitely white. Yeah. Yes, yes. So they, again, that would be 1939 version of softening.
I was going to say, you know, politically also at that time, though, you know, FDR's New Deal coalition was, I mean, the Southern Democrat, white Democrats made up an important part. I don't know how much that sort of, you know, top level politics influences any of this.
Huge.
Okay.
Oh, they were absolutely, Hollywood was just hand in glove with the government.
Yeah, okay.
Throughout the World War II is just remarkable for them just saying, what do you want? What do you need?
Right.
And it will be in the movies. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Looney Tunes was definitely very enthusiastic about the war. That's my main film history knowledge.
all the ones that you can't see because they're in the vault that are violently racist and so on, which is,
But there's another strain of, you might call it the Portis strain. I mean, Portis, Charles Portis, author of True Grit, and I'd say his best novel, Dog of the South, Gringos, Masters of Atlantis, a really superb prose stylist from Arkansas, was pretty much a neo-Confederate and got more so as he went along, so that there's a line in the last novel he wrote, Gringos, a Mexican character says, you know why I'm depressed? The Yankees took half my country in 1846. And Jimmy Burns, the protagonist, says, you know, they took all of mine in 1865. So you know where Portis stands. Matty Ross, for example, is a big fan of Woodrow Wilson. Matty Ross is his invented first-person narrator for True Grit and a great, great voice, one of the great voices. But there's another movie that came out of that from more of an action novelist that I'm talking about the outlaw Josie Wiles, which is Wales. Many of these, a good movie with a really nasty ideology behind it. But it's not in your face the way Birth of a Nation was.
No.
You can think of Eastwood, who's the protagonist, as just a man, or rather a superman, in difficult circumstances. But he happens to be a Confederate veteran, and that means a lot in terms of the film.
Well, and you do open on that, don't they? They burn his entire farm, and they don't they rape his wife and daughter or something?
Kill his unit, which his Confederate unit, which is trying to surrender with a Gatling gun, which is utter nonsense.
Right.
Nothing like that ever happened. and the more you focus on the Civil War aspects, the more grotesque and partisan it seems. But I think most people don't need to do that.
I saw it as a kid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you guys see it when it came out? Because I remember seeing it as a kid and thinking it was a really good movie. I mean, again, I was a kid and I didn't.
Well, it was.
Oh, it is a good movie.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I guess this comes up several times in this discussion. May as well say it. I don't see any reason that you shouldn't have a horrible person who happens to be good at making a certain kind of thing, whether it's shoes or movies or books or whatever. Why not? I mean, making good movies or books, as far as I know, doesn't imply any kind of moral superiority. And look at literary biographies and you can find a lot of proof that it doesn't. So I'm not even sure it's a paradox, but happens a lot anyway.
Yeah.
It just poses a huge challenge to people of our time. For some reason, they can't seem to get around the hurdle of, wow, what an utter shit bastard, but boy, that's a good novel. I don't know why that's hard, but we were raised in a different era.
That brings us to our era. And you've written, I got to tell everybody, you have written amazing reviews in the last decade about this cohort or generation's attempt to do the Civil War. I think my favorite is your review of Nate Parker's
Birth. He called it Birth of a Nation, but it's the Nat Turner.
Which was not smart either. And about the Nat Turner Rebellion. And Eileen just says outright there that we shouldn't even try to make movies like this because basically we don't have the sensibility, or more crudely, we don't have the guts, you know, something like that.
And maybe even we don't have the imagination. We're just getting to a point where people can no longer imagine their way into it and aren't interested in it, which is shocking to me. Because I was trying to convey, because, you know, it's not like we have the jailhouse confessions of Nat Turner. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. that his whole conception was very complete, but it was very Old Testament. A kind of cosmic view of the role of Christ, and was calling him to lead this rebellion, and he had visions that were bloody and beautiful. And so I go to this movie thinking, oh, finally, somebody's going to do it. It's so cinematic. Yeah. It's going to be unbelievable. And in every way, it's just the most imaginatively impoverished thing I'd ever seen. There literally looks like a Victoria's Secret model who's black, who comes flying up with angel's wings as part of his vision. I'm just like, what the hell are you doing? Wow. And the main thing that Nat Turner wanted to get across in jail, as he's waiting to be executed, is everyone's trying to get him to say it's because your master was cruel to you, right? That you just snapped and you went on a rampage. And he insisted, no, he was kind to me. He gave me many responsibilities because he treated me well.
Yeah.
He was trying to refuse the whole, it's because you had a mean master, right?
Right.
Yeah.
They put it right back in. So it's all about the specific abuses of Nat Turner and his wife by the evil slaveholders.
It's almost outlawed Josie Wales story, in a way, isn't it? Yeah. It's like they came in and raped my wife, and therefore I'm going to go against. Yeah.
Yeah. Which never happened. There's nothing in the record, nothing like that. And it's so against what he was trying to get across. It doesn't matter if your master's nice.
Yep.
Slavery is bad.
Still slavery. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's just, that was heartbreaking. That was just heartbreaking to see that one. And it's been pretty heartbreaking to watch these films. I mean, sometimes it's kind of funny, like Emancipation, watching the latest one, the Will Smith one, where it's action film Will Smith vehicle combined with.
Yeah, it's a famous photo that seems to have started that one. The horribly scarred back of an ex-slave, usually identified as someone named Gordon, but
And the photo is called "The Scourged Back," and it was great for propaganda.
Scars standing out on his bare back, but somehow.
And again, they have the narrative. He gave an account of it to, I think, the medics who treated him. So we have the account. It was so promising again, you know, because he had to escape through the Louisiana swamps to join
Grant.
I got to
read this. I got to read this little bit. But at every turn in Fuqua's movie, the already amazing story is pumped full of gratuitous, tall tale action hero nonsense. It reaches its nadir when Peter... I guess that's Will Smith, right? Already weakened by a bullet wound and hiding in the swamp to escape the relentless slave hunters on his trail, is attacked by a massive alligator. I love that it's a massive alligator. Fights in a protracted, roiling battle underwater and wins. You can hardly roll your eyes hard enough to express how absurd this scene is. But save your eye-rolling ability for the bee and snake attacks, because all of nature is out to get Peter during his... Oh, boy.
Okay, now I want to watch that.
Yeah, that seems kind of worth it.
Wow.
Yeah, because, of course, he's Will Smith always has to be a kind of Superman himself. And so that's what it is, rampaging through the Louisiana swamp.
You should have just slapped the alligator.
I know. Just punched him in the nose.
Slap.
I remember an Australian expert on crocodilians said, jumping into a billabong and fighting a giant saltwater croc underwater, that's roughly like fighting a Volkswagen, a croc that size.
God.
I know. And it just, you know, it's funny, but it's also infuriating. I mean, come on, respect the animal. Respect the animal.
I got to just read another little bit here because, obviously the slap heard around the world and the movie didn't do well and they blamed it on Will Smith's slap heard around the world. And as you write here, the publicity campaign for Emancipation was called Will Smith's, quote, apology tour in the Wall Street Journal. But there's a simpler explanation for the film's unpopularity. It's pretty bad. Yeah.
I'm probably glad they had the excuse. But yeah.
The recent one you liked, I think, was one I didn't see, I have to admit. I didn't get the streaming service or whatever it is. The Good Lord Bird, right? You liked some of that.
I did. I liked it, and typically perverse of a film critic, I never went back and finished the series, but I loved the first couple of episodes. I think it's got six. Yeah, it's of all people, Ethan Hawke pulls off the Titanic role of John Brown, but the approach to it, and it's based on a novel by, I'm blanking, I guess it was a hugely successful respected novel, I forget, but anyway, is a very, you know, extreme absurdist tall tale, but it's still has tremendous resonance, and John Brown will always come through with these kind of shards of brilliance, but he's kind of this ranting mad freak figure, and it's about a young slave that he kind of takes under his wing, and it's from the point of view of, his name is Henry Shackelford, of this teenage boy who's brought in on the whole little sort of private campaign of John Brown with his sons and everything else, and it wants to include with, you know, real elements of greatness, real elements of truly American madness and religious fanaticism and all the rest of it in just a wild, you know, comedy drama mix that it was so refreshing and so like beyond what I thought anyone would attempt that I was really thrilled with it.
One of the reasons I didn't, you know, enroll in the streaming service that had that was Ethan Hawke. I mean,
I know.
He always looks tired and snotty, and I can't imagine him as.
I know. It's amazing what, you know, that kind of hawk-like, you know, hair standing up and a beard and all the rest of it can do. It really helps a lot. He should never wear his hair any other way.
But you raise a really interesting point that has a lot to do with trying to construe the people involved in the U.S. Civil War and a lot of other events of that period. The question of was John Brown insane? And one of the things that happened to me when I started reading more intensely for our Radio War Nerd Civil War series was that if you took a big sample of Civil War generals, both sides, all different armies, a lot of them would be described as borderline crazy in my own youth. And now, because many more people are getting diagnosed in childhood as being, in the idiom of a few years ago, on the spectrum, I think virtually all of them would. And so to the point that it started to seem like you can't talk about a particular general being insane because they all were. And so that it becomes a non sequitur. And you can't use it as a mitigating circumstance. And you begin to think, what does it mean anyway? It means they would not have seemed normal in our world, but duh. That's why you don't have to worry about time travel. It doesn't work that way. Braxton Bragg, for example, a famous Confederate general who was maybe the most hated man in any command, once, according to an apocryphal story that could well be true, he quarreled with everybody he ever met. And eventually, because of illness, he was required to take two jobs on the same post. Like he was in charge of supplies and he was in charge of drill or whatever. And supposedly he wrote a furious letter to the supply officer, which was himself, on behalf of the officer who was in charge of drill, which was himself. A lot of them are like that. I mean, the frequency with which Civil War generals kill each other, and not always in duels, more like shoot somebody in the back of the head coming out of a pub. That happened a lot. The question of, and this goes way beyond the Civil War, but you talk about it really brilliantly in that article, is like, what do you do with the idea of someone who's crazy according to the contemporary definitions? Is it a mitigating factor, first of all, or not? I don't know, but it's a very big question because, I don't know, all insults are ableist. No cultural moment can live without insults. I don't know how that ends. I guess it has to be endlessly renegotiated.
Well, and a lot depends on your own stance toward crazy. For me, I always feel very much at home reading about the 19th century because I just feel a cousinly sense of identification. Yeah. I mean, there's almost nothing you can read that's extensive that doesn't bring you into the world of constant, like, mental drift into other states. They're either having wild premonitions of their own death, like Lincoln, or they're some of which seem to come true, or they're going into what they used to call brain fever, which would be fits of illness that didn't seem to have a physical cause, but just put people in bed for 6 months where they were raving and out of their heads, or just all sorts of hallucinatory experiences, all that religious, very, very intense religious fervor. You know, so by our standards, they were out of their heads more than in. So it just seems like Brown is on such a continuum.
Nat Turner.
So again, Nat Turner.
Yeah.
Yep.
Nat Turner. And, you know, I tried to ground it by saying, look at, you know, Lincoln's second inaugural. He's using language that sounds like something Nat Turner might have said. you know, about, you know, the every drop of blood drawn from, you know, the lash will have to be paid by another drawn from the sword, you know, this whole, and, you know, the ways of the Lord are true and righteous, et cetera. Yeah. You know, this kind of move that they would make mentally, readily, that we now regard as you can't even refer to that or talk about that or assess it, which I don't.
Right. I think Mark has also worked on this in a really useful way in Going Postal on the question of, you know, were these guys just mentally ill? And it's this always reminds me of that of Svidrigailov's line before he kills himself in Crime and Punishment, which is, okay, maybe you're right, and I only see ghosts because I'm out of my mind. Mm-hmm. But the fact that ghosts only appear to insane people doesn't prove there are no ghosts.
Oh, I've got to write that down. That's one of my favorite lines of yours. Explains my whole family history. I got to write that down.
And as Mark said, and I may be paraphrasing this badly, that there are absolutely valid reasons to stage a workplace uprising, not the same ones, but somewhat parallel to any other uprising, any insurgencies, servile or otherwise, but they strike certain people first. A lot of more phlegmatic or, if you like, sane or normal people will put up with it until they die. And
we tend to consider sanity is very recognizable in terms of the discussion, in that there's a kind of quietism. Like no one must roil the waters, because that's akin to losing your mind. So this whole idea of we mustn't if you're going to make a move away from favoring the South altogether, then you have to start saying war is madness, war is hell. Yeah. That's the move that you start getting in the 50s, 60s, the Shenandoah, for example, in 65. So because I kept thinking, surely when I get to the civil rights era, you'll start to see, you know, pro-union, pro-abolition. You don't. You still don't.
You get nervous, almost.
Yeah, you get nervous, bland, pacifist films about just war being bad. And Shenandoah has speeches about that.
Who's in Shenandoah again? Can you describe
Jimmy
that film?
Stewart.
Right, exactly.
He's playing the patriarch of a Virginia family who's trying to stay neutral in the war, which I can't even finish that sentence without laughing.
They sing that song a lot, Shenandoah.
That's it. That's the hit song from that movie. It's all, and you can go to, you know, mustn't have big fusses like wars, and the family is all important and unite them. And it's also he's a small farmer, not a big planter, and he runs like a little democracy workshop with his family at his own dinner table. And so
that's a big advance over those plantations that are, you know, lionized in those earlier films.
That's true.
That's a really big advance.
That's an interesting point.
When did plantations go from being a nice backdrop for
a fairy tale? I mean, really, like a real fairy tale land of princesses.
Yeah. Well, who played Scarlett O'Hara what's her name?
Vivian Leigh.
She's a British actress. Yeah.
Some actress back then. And as she's called in Confederacy of Dunces, Scarlett O'Hara. And God knows why. Actually, it's an interesting question. Why did she become Scarlett O'Hara? Because that would be a pretty unusual name.
I could tell you the whole story. I used to be a fervent as a child, literally third grade, Gone with the Wind fan.
Really?
Third grade, reading this tome. Wow. And they rebuked me for it, saying, you can't read that. It's too adult. I was like,
it's a thousand pages, and I'm reading it.
A great melodrama. I mean, if you can ignore again the horrifying ideology of the thing, it works on the level, and it really works as a Hollywood melodrama. But anyway, her whole background is this: she's supposed to be split evenly between a jumped up Irishman who manages to win a plantation in a poker game and an aristocratic mother. Southern mother he manages to marry. So that's the explanation of what's wrong
with her. I was wondering why in the film, I've only watched parts of the film, but the father had this kind of semi-Irish accent.
It's Thomas Mitchell. He's a famous Irish-American
What is that going
character?
On? That didn't make any sense. In the South?
I know. So he manages to crash the gates and get accepted in a way he never would have been because he wins this thing. But at any rate, that's the explanation for why she's so wild and impossible and innocent, a proper Southern lady. It's she's got half wild Irish blood.
Wild Irish, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and supposedly, I've read analyses of the account saying this movie, the novel was already just a colossal bestseller before the film was such a huge hit. And part of it, they said, was that it hit every button. Certainly in America, it even had an immigrant kind of tale, which is the Irish.
Right.
Yeah, they were getting served up in movies at that time.
There a lot.
Yeah,
a lot. Turning.
Because there's always some group that's getting served up in mainstream movies.
Right.
There's another film that's really interesting because it came out, I think, around 1971, again with Clint Eastwood. The Beguiled.
Oh, yeah.
A strange
Wow, is
kind
it strange?
Of, wow, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, you got to see it, Mark.
Quasi-psychedelic Civil War movie, although far inferior to The Great Northfield Minnesota Raid, which has something to do with the Civil War also. But it was remade, that's the interesting thing, by none other than your own favorite,
Sophia Coppola.
Yeah.
Sophia Coppola, yeah. Yeah, and she takes all the psychedelic, all the sexual fever dream, all the everything good and interesting about the first, and tries to make it a blandly sense-making film, and it can't work that way. So she's trying to make a kind of pro-women narrative as they take on this interloper who uses his that is the story. It's a Union soldier,
a lone Yankee soldier.
Yes.
I take it. Yes,
who uses
He's
using his sexual wiles to keep the women from turning him over to the Confederate Army.
Yeah.
So he can.
And he's a Yankee and he's very bad. I remember very distinctly.
Yeah.
Like it's 1972. I'm in high school. I'm basically, totally out of it for various reasons. And I go to see this movie with my class and. It begins with Eastwood shooting for no particular reason this Southern soldier who's disarmed or something and can't threaten him in any way. And I remember even then thinking, why did he do that? That's funny.
Oh, and there's a song playing that's like something like, don't let mothers don't let your sons go off to be soldiers. So it's again, it's got this weird.
Wait, so it's mamas don't let your. Babies grow up to be cowboys?
But no, instead it's soldiers. Okay. It's not that song, but the message. So it's, again, blaming the war on everyone having gone mad. So it's, again, another of these pacifist war is hell, and it creates these,
And the sexual tension included literally every female
including
in the
little 12-year-old girl.
12-year-old.
Everyone.
I remember her screaming when he kills her turtle.
Pet turtle.
Mr. Turtle! That was quite a moment.
Because they essentially, symbolically castrate him by re-break. He's wounded and they re-break his leg. They push him downstairs or something. Because he's, working them all. He's seducing them all and promising all everything. And they push him downstairs or something and he re-breaks it so badly. And then they just use that as a reason to amputate his leg. And so then he's mad. Then he's mad, and he's threatening to go on this huge rampage, and that's when he picks up the turtle and throws it against the wall, kills the turtle. And the young
just
girl
doesn't
like that.
Because they amputated his leg? God. Cranky, these Yankee
killers.
He gets
very cranky. But it's really interesting because, Clint Eastwood hated looking back on it because it failed, and he said, nobody wanted to see me like that. Using his sexual wiles on all the women, which is very Eastwood, actually, but also being an emasculated loser. So that was why he blamed, the film didn't do well. But it's such a weird-ass film. I really actually love the film because it's
the craziest damn film. I guess that's why I didn't see it, because it flopped. And as you say, but unsurprisingly, the French loved it.
Oh, yeah. The French loved it, yeah. And it has
a
wonderful...
What does Coppola do with all that, old Sophie?
Nothing. She does almost nothing. She sort of keeps the bare bones. He does seduce them all, and they do get their revenge on him. But it's supposed to be all about, these poor women... so oppressed in their society and blah, blah, blah. And then he naturally, reaps the whirlwind of their oppression. But it just makes no sense. She will not deal with the fact that with any fact. So there are no, one of the first complaints, you know, by critics was there are no black people in the South, like none.
Wow. That's right.
And even Eastwood's version, there was at least one.
Oh, there's a major character.
Yeah.
Who's the one who has to do most of the
work there. Leave it to Sofia Coppola.
Oh, she's perfect. I mean, it's like she's so perfect.
A whole war about slavery and racism, and she makes it about, like, whatever. Oh, my God.
So her explanation, her dialogue in the thing is the slaves left. That's her only explanation put in dialogue in the movie. And outside of it, she defended herself by saying she only wanted to deal with gender politics, not racial. Oh.
Yeah, so she picked the Civil War.
One issue at a time.
I know, exactly. Oh, my God. But, you know, there's no shortage of food. There's no patched clothing. So none of the realities of war are real in the movie. You're just like,
even
what?
Birth of a Nation has the patched clothes. Yeah. And stuff, you know?
Like every Little Women, you know, of the old time, they always make a big deal about their clothes are terrible and tatty and endlessly repatched. Yeah, nothing. Yeah. She will not give any territory over to actual on the ground reality. So it's really,
she is like, I mean, she's like 5-star mediocrity. I don't even know. Mediocrity almost gives mediocrity a bad name. There's just something about her. She,
guess what she said about the South? She goes to the South for the first time and says,
"Oh no,
I loved it. It was so exotic and different."
Wow. Oh. I remember a discussion about that in Berkeley with, the more direct the horrible oppression is, that's good. That's bad. Well, no, actually, you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. But at least, Django Unchained, which is another pre-Civil War, I guess.
Pre-Civil War, but
at least there were some direct scenes, like when you have, if you're going to kill people for a living, you got to kill that guy farming and his kids got to come out and cry over the body. That happens, you know. That I kind of appreciated that scene.
Mm-hmm.
I like that movie better than you. I don't know what you thought about it, John, but I know.
I had a horribly hard time. I know you guys liked it better than me. I think I just expected something so totally
different. Well, you had seen the script and you were like, wow. Yeah. And that might have ruined it, like seeing A Christmas Present before it comes. But I mean, it's not his best movie by any stretch, but I just thought it was more, it had more energy and life and ups and downs, and just it was more of a spectacle than most
movies. And that is what I liked about the overall. He gave a series of interviews before he did it, saying the way we need to reclaim the whole, at least the slavery narrative, is we really need to start doing great genre versions of it and bringing this kind of, you know, liveliness and everything. Because he said this PBS thing we've done to it has deadened it.
Yes.
For everyone. And I thought, that's exactly right. That's right. So I was so, but I had really gotten it into my head that he was doing a slave rebellion movie. So I was so thwarted when there was no slave rebellion. In fact, there seemed to be a point being made, which I couldn't quite track, about him being unable to draft any other slave. So it just made Django kind of this, he's the towering figure, but no one else would join him. No, I couldn't quite follow. But anyway.
That's interesting, because has there been a slave rebellion movie by any American
other than
studio?
The Matt Turner attempt?
Yeah, but
I mean, didn't Roots have some of that?
Oh, I guess it did.
Yeah.
It's,
I think we should point out here to people, I know I can't remember it either, that when Roots came, Alex Haley, who also ghost wrote, I think, Malcolm X's autobiography, right?
Yeah.
Or co-wrote or something. But that was made into a TV series in the 70s. I mean, you can't really call it, you can call it a leading up to the Civil War, I guess, series. But that was one of the most impactful.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of.
Everyone was glued to that
TV events. I mean, in my lifetime, it was.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
I don't think there's anything close to it. It had a huge cultural effect.
That was a TV movie at a time.
TV series.
Yes. They weren't cool at all.
They
weren't.
Yes.
Yeah,
and then Holocaust came after that. And that's kind of what made the Holocaust. That was with Meryl Streep.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of made her career. And it also kind of made, like, the Holocaust, because it wasn't quite front and center before, at least as I recall, until the Holocaust series came out.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about that comes out in Eileen's review of Nat Turner. As you say in the review, Nat Turner said and acted on it, every member of the Planter families
has to be killed.
Yes. And
men, women, and children.
Yes.
How you can do a Nat Turner Rebellion movie without any of that?
Exactly. They don't do it.
Difficult to see.
The implication is, I think, that they are doing it, but you're not allowed to see it. So you only see them go after the specific men who were abusive.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
You know, so it's really chickening out in just a terrible way. If you're not going to deal with Nat Turner, don't do the Nat Turner story. I just can't. It drives me crazy.
But I think it's almost because the culture, the culture might have had a hard time with it because there's so much lost causeism coursing through our veins.
Absolutely.
It's not like if you had, Jewish partisans going into some German town, like it would be okay that they kill the family of, camp guards and the whole family. Mm-hmm. I think people would be able to deal with it, or there'd be this sort of like fake moral ambiguity, but, had to do it sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think people are, a large audience anyway, is ready for that, what he did, which was kill families.
Yeah, he spared any of the small farmer classes. Yeah. If you weren't planting glassy, they went right by you. Yeah.
Right.
So there was this absolute judgment of who had to die. It's interesting, in Emancipation, I didn't mention it, but there actually is a shot of a little girl who's the child of one of the planter families screaming in a really monstrous way. She's supposed to be this child of evil. She sees the runaway Peter, played by Will Smith, and starts screaming, "Runner, runner, runner." She looks like something in something in a horror movie.
I'm thinking Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
It's very much shot like that. It's a kind of shock shot on her face that seems to be a gesture toward, they're all filled with this ideology. You can't just leave leave these people to just rebuild the same society again, which is essentially what they did.
Yeah.
A version of it. But so that was one interesting, sort of interesting moment, I guess. But it was such an anomaly I didn't even write about.
No.
But yeah.
After I read your review, I was trying to think as an individual. I mean, what culture could do
Nat
Turner Rebellion?
Can't even.
Yeah.
That's why I was so shocked when I saw. I've always wanted someone to do it, but I was so shocked when I saw that they actually were doing it. Like, wow, okay. I hope you've got the guts for this. But they always mess it up. I mean, there was a kind of minor version of the Harriet Tubman story came out a couple years ago, and the same week, and with her, there's none of that. You don't have to worry. She's just rescuing slaves.
Yeah,
that should be an easy one.
Yeah.
But she also had visions. She had visions because if you believe the scientific explanation, she was horribly, she was hit on the head with some sort of iron weight. I forget what it was, what sort of farm implement that cracked her skull, and she wasn't expected to live. And when she came out of it, she was seeing visions and hearing God talk to her. Mm. And she always claimed that's how she could navigate the swamp. She could just do the impossible things. That's how.
That's cool.
So they were going to do the visions, and it was the same thing. It's like they go to the most generic, a cache of dream imagery that they go to. And yes, let's have a rippling stream and little tinkling bell sounds. And I'm like, no!
Harriet!
No!
Harriet!
Exactly.
Yeah.
You must save them, Harriet! Yeah. Yeah, so
there aren't many movies that deal with... As you say, altered states very well. Yeah. Certainly not the one movie that was called that. Eraserhead to me is always the best.
Yes. Yeah, Lynch is good. Lynch is usually pretty good.
He always can do it. Yeah,
that's one of his great gifts. Yeah, but it's
so maybe rare. It's a difficult thing. I know when I was trying and failing to write fiction, I tried to do dreams, and I discovered it is hard to do dreams or visions or. Schizophrenic, whatever. It's tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. But, go ahead.
Well,
I was just going to say, in some cases, you have accounts. That's what's frustrating.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fiction schmixen. Just write what they...
just write what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to... let's go back to, another part of this story. I mean, we're talking Civil War movies.
Mm-hmm.
We should talk, I think, about... battle scenes. One thing you like Civil War battles as depicted in movies. One thing you point out, it's really true, is that for some damn reason, as far as I know, there's no There's no movie about Sherman. I mean, the most photogenic of all generals.
Grant or Sherman.
Grant is also very photo and so interesting, Grant.
Oh,
and
so
has
interesting.
Like the greatest, you know, autobiography of any president bar none.
And
when Lance Henriksen was young enough, he could have been Sherman with no makeup down.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and you know, compared to like the fancy pants, Patton is a will. He's a nothing compared to a George C. Scott is much more better than the real Patton, I think. But like compared to Sherman, he's just not nearly as interesting.
I always say, you're coming through eras of Hollywood filmmaking when the glorifying biopic was like a major thing.
Yes.
And they gave him to everybody, but not to Grant.
They only would do Lincoln and then
even that.
Yeah.
Avoiding controversial Lincoln by making it young Mr. Lincoln, Abe Lincoln in Illinois,
or Lincoln, old vampire Lincoln. Killer.
Okay, that one's good.
I know. That's different.
Yeah.
Best Civil War movie ever, but okay. Yeah. But so
did they make any about Robert E. Lee? I wonder.
Surprisingly, I don't even know one of Robert E. Lee.
Yeah,
though it's interesting to note that the cult of Robert E. Lee has only recently started to fall apart.
Yes. Isn't there a Robert E. Lee character in Gods and Generals, I seem to remember, or no?
Well, he's certainly in Gettysburg.
Gettysburg.
He's in both of those. But I don't think
he was played by Eric Cartman.
That's right.
You're just dying to get to Gettysburg, John. I think you should go for it.
It does have some great battle scenes, but I also want to mention a movie that probably wasn't a great movie, but it did have a scene that did suggest, in a way that most don't, the flat-out terrifying nature of a Civil War battle, and that was Glory, where there's a scene where these troops, who I think were in their first battle, are having to stand while cannon just rip through their ranks. First of all, that suggests that Matthew Broderick was a really bad officer. Robert Gould Shaw was a bad officer because you're supposed to tell your troops to lie down. That's when an officer comes into his own. He's supposed to stand and then tell the troops to get up when it's time for them to fire their first volley. But it didn't always happen. So that was real in that way. And it's one of the most difficult to imagine things I can find in any movie, because it's one thing to do Pickett's Charge with, you know, those big strings of an orchestra in Gettysburg and everybody falling operatically. But it's quite another to stand there silent, not moving at all. And occasionally, now and then, a cannonball splatters somebody two rows to the right.
I remember thinking that was a pretty good movie.
It was.
Broderick, it was just weird. Maybe in the end, I don't know, maybe if I saw it now, it'd be different. It was just sort of like Ferris.
I know. I had the same feeling when I said it. And I kept thinking, are they trying to characterize him? Is he supposed to be sort of a weeny little nothing?
He was very much upper class Boston. But if they think that was weeny, they don't really understand.
Right. Yeah.
Isn't it just a case of they found somebody to anchor the movie and his stock was still pretty
high
after Ferris Bueller? And
he
was looking for a role that was more dramatic. And,
right.
So Matthew's people talked to these people. And, they did lunch. And
Exactly. And for a long time, Glory was pretty much what you could hold up. It's like, this is a good Civil War movie. It's pretty sparse.
I just wanted to get back to if you don't mind me doing this, just back to Civil War battles. Like, do you have a sense of how battle scenes kind of
As I was going to talk to you guys, I thought, oh, geez, I hope they can make up for this, because suddenly I'm like blanking. Like, most of the ones I'm dealing with, it's amazing how you don't see battles.
Yeah.
Right.
Most of them don't have battles.
Most of them don't have them, I think, actually, is the whole thing.
It's expensive. It's especially difficult to find people thin enough to play Civil War soldiers. So sometimes the camera in Gettysburg battle scenes couldn't pan fast enough. Like, whoa, what has that regiment been eating?
Now, I was thinking, too, though, about the spaghetti westerns, was particularly Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I can't remember if the Civil War is a backdrop to any of the other ones, but it is a backdrop.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me because there's a little bit in the article about just how readily the aspects of Southern culture just move right into the Western. So you've always got Southerners,
yes,
either just because they inform the Western hero, you know, kind of gentleman, man of honor ethos, but the literal will be a Southerner.
And also just the rebel, the individual protagonist is always going to be, because like even in those movies and a lot of other ones, really until Glory, in a sense, the Union is kind of like big government. You know what I mean? It's big. It's kind of, it's slow. It's dumb. It's kind of scary. It can overwhelm you. In the end, it wins, but it's not likable at all. It's just, as a character, it's almost just reminds me of how, the rebel type would see the government, the machine, man.
Oh, yeah. They had such an easy way of characterizing. Yeah. Yes, exactly. That military force is just like, you can't, that's what Buster Keaton means, I'm sure. It's how do you make heroes of those people? That's why seeing Shenandoah, it has this very, really gentle, decent Union officer trying to do the right thing, played by George Kennedy, which he usually played the villain or the big comical lout. Yep. And I literally just froze. I couldn't believe what I was seeing because you just get so used to seeing, if it's a Yankee uniform, you're looking at some reprobate or worthless member, faceless member of an invading horde. You just never see this. So it was quite a shocking moment.
But, John, I have to just say, because you used to make everybody watch Gettysburg.
Yes.
So I think at this point you do have to say something about the film.
And it's got all the battles. It's all battle.
Well, as you both know, I've watched some parts of Gettysburg many hundreds of times. but it's hard to bear in some parts. Basically, it's hard to bear until the battles start. And to its credit, it does have a lot of battles.
Yes.
Although they're a bit cheesy, but a lot of, I don't know, battle fans can handle a lot of cheese, which is why they don't look good in those uniforms. And the scene on Little Round Top, which any Civil War fan has been reading about since they were about 7 years old, is cheesy but good, partly because of the fact that Jeff Daniels' mustache is a character in its own right.
Yes, and I was going to say that was
pretty much acts him off the stage.
Yeah, I couldn't get over it. It was like a junior high school production when it came to the beards and the mustaches and stuff. Like, guys, it's like they ran out of money when it came to they just went to the local 7-Eleven and got a beard.
One of the most striking things about it is that. As you quote Portis in one of your reviews, Eileen, we are less than our fathers. We don't even look like them. We very much don't look like them.
Yes.
For one thing, we're much heavier, most of us. And also, we're a lot older when we actually accomplish something. Yes. Most of those Civil War generals were very young. You kind of had to be. It was a pretty strenuous job at anything below corps commander. You had to get out there. I've just been reading yesterday about a Confederate general who was very ineffective. Can't remember his name at the moment, but everyone blamed it on his age, which was mid-50s, and that was considered far too old to be a general, a field commander.
Just because of all the physical activity.
They all look too fleshy. They all look too old. And they do talk in Gettysburg a bit like Civil War era upper echelon people talk. That is, they speak in full sentences without coming off like Martin from The Simpsons. but I think that's hard for our culture to do, so it doesn't always work very well.
Right.
What are the components of a good Civil War battle scene? They have to ideally look like they could be Civil War people. But what, like, are there components you can say this is what makes it good? Or just accuracy or something like that?
Yeah.
I or think some indefinable X
Well, no,
factor.
Like, it's oddly similar in my memory to why Kyle MacLachlan was perfect for Blue Velvet, but god-awful as Paul Muad'Dib, because he was such a namby-pamby suburb boy, perfect for Blue Velvet, not at all right for the only son of an aristocratic house of the old school, that because they killed. There's a line in The Tempest that is often misunderstood, where Ariel says to her father, "Be something like, be careful, for he is gentle and quick to anger," which seems paradoxical in contemporary terms, but isn't at all. Gentle means of good birth, and therefore he'll kill you in a second. And you need to find someone who can play Muad'Dib, who's both, you know, very snotty and aristocratic and a killer. And you need something rather similar for any Civil War officer. And it ain't Timothy Chalamet or whatever his name is. And it ain't Kyle MacLachlan either.
Yeah.
One thing I'll say about Birth of a Nation is the young men look pretty authentic. I mean, they like, don't you think, Eileen? They have that kind of ghostly, older than their age, chiseled, fit in these fancy clothes, kind of just,
I think you can still find it easier back in the 1910s.
Yeah,
than,
exactly,
than
to
later.
Find people that look like that. And they were able to have, D.W. Griffith was able to film like columns of these people marching, and you didn't have to, as John said, you know, pan away quickly because they all look like they just got back from Chipotle or something. So it's like, they really did look the part. But I guess, Eileen, if you could name, I don't know, three or five Civil War films. I mean, you know, I haven't done the numbers or anything, but I might gather that roughly half of our audience is not American. So I don't know, which ones would you recommend?
Oh, it's a tough one. Just because there's so few that are really good. But I'll tell you what ones I like. I like The General. We were talking about this before the show started, which is Buster Keaton's masterpiece, is considered, and he plays it.
That was surprisingly good,
It's excellent. It holds up the way most silent films
do. Yeah, it does. I mean, I have to admit, I don't get Charlie Chaplin. I'm willing to admit I'm probably missing something. And yet I do get Buster Keaton.
Keaton stays much more contemporary. He really does, I mean, he doesn't have the same, you know, Chaplin wanted to stay invested in a melodramatic world that was pretty much dead by the time he was he was making films. But, you know, not Keaton. He's resolutely modern and even contemporary. But it's, you know, it's because he's into things that are so fascinating. He's basically trying to recover his train, which is being stolen. He's an engineer.
Yes.
And you just get into the marvelous logistics of weight and mass. And it's just gags built on endlessly trying to maneuver by himself, run a train, get his train back, come back at the exact same route on the same tracks with all now. But now you've got to prevent them from catching you in another train. And it's just because of the ruthless logic of the comedic unfolding that it just remains intensely fascinating and actually quite funny. But it's also just got – it's just beautifully atmospheric.
It's really cool. I watch it on a big TV, which I haven't – you know, normally you just watch on a little screen. But on a big TV, you see it's pretty cool. I mean, the technology is already a lot better in 1925 than 1915.
Yeah, definitely.
And
Keaton looks wonderful in period costume, and he would spare no expense. You know, his profits were never what they should have been because he just would spend so much money to get it just right. He literally destroyed this vintage train. Wow. There's a scene where a stupid general has to order a train to cross to cross a bridge over a chasm, claiming that, which is on fire, the bridge is on fire, claiming it will hold. And then you get this wonderful jaw-sagging moment when, of course, the whole train slowly collapses and falls into the chasm. And Keaton, of course, you know, did that whole thing. Got it, found it, refurbished it, and destroyed it.
And I can see why he chose to be on the Confederate side, because the Confederates are inherently funnier than the Union. I mean, I think there's so much more comic setup, like, you know, the including like the girlfriend who's like, you know, you didn't enlist. Never, you know.
He's up against Southern ideology. He does. There's a wonderful short film if you've never
good
seen.
Way
also,
of putting it.
It's very period. It's more antebellum, but it's another confrontation of his. He's trying to marry a Southern girl. And the her father and brothers hate him, and he's an interloping northerner. And so they keep trying to waylay him out of the house to kill him. But because Southern hospitality dictates that as long as he's in the house, they can't kill him because he's a guest. So there's just all these wonderful, you know, frantic runs and, you know, leaping into windows and everything to get back in the house so they can't kill him. So anyway, our hospitality, also excellent. But I love a movie called The Tall Target. It's about Lincoln trying. It's kind of pre-war, but it's just infused with arguments and passionate takes on slavery and the Union and, you know, the Confederacy.
It's
and
about
the
attempted assassination of Lincoln when he was going to go through Baltimore for the inauguration, which was, as far as I know, quite a real plot.
Yes, it was a real plot apparently, and he had to, as he said, never. He has a beautiful line, but it's something about having to sneak in to his own inauguration like a thief in the night.
Right.
No president had ever had to do that. And it's just, again, it's one of the few very pro-Northern films of that era. It's a 1951 film. It's done in beautiful black and white. And it's just all about this attempt to, on the part of a police detective who's kind of gone rogue, to try to prevent what he's heard is going to be this assassination attempt, and it's all on this train, but you've got the kind of microcosm of America, of people arguing their positions, which sounds dull, but it actually works wonderfully. So that's a great film by Anthony Mann, who's a great filmmaker, did a lot of film noir and a lot of Westerns, and then combined the Westerns and film noir together in great configurations. So he's quite good. I'm trying to think what else. Obviously, Glory. Everyone's got to see Glory. Mm. You know, I will say it's become a thing not to say now, and usually I don't like Spielberg, but there are sections of Spielberg's Lincoln that I actually quite like, even though it's got unfortunate Spielberg-y stuff all over it. But what I like about it is it has the sections where it's focusing on the job at hand, which is how can Lincoln get the 13th Amendment passed when he doesn't have the votes? And it actually gets into kind of comical sequences, and James Spader is strangely good as this kind of fat political hustler.
I remember he looked dirty.
He looked dirty,
most
greasy.
Most people don't.
And he's very convincing.
I like James Spader.
He's good. He's good. And they've just got to, you know, it doesn't matter what they offer him anything. I think they've got to turn four votes or something to get it passed. And just the intricacies of that I really liked, because that was an unusual take. It wasn't the typical take. It wasn't the typical angle on getting into the war. So I like sections of it. But again, sections of it are horribly Spielberg-y.
Yeah. But it was surprising. I guess what was the big surprise at that time, I remember people being very excited about it, was that it was pro-North, unabashedly pro-North, which was just – and there has been that cultural turn – just very recently.
Recently, I mean, as hell.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Like Glory kind of came out of nowhere, but it's not like it spawned a whole new look. But it's just very, very recently that all of a sudden they're all, and it hasn't necessarily made all the movies better, but at least it's made them ideologically better. But
easier to watch.
Exactly.
I mean, because unfortunately, the one I was really hoping for was The Free State of Jones.
Yeah.
Yes. And I just wound up not liking that so much. And
I didn't think it was that bad, but I guess I had I went into it actually with very low expectations.
Oh, that's the best way. Yeah.
Yeah. I had very low expectations and thought it was all right.
Did they make Corinth, Mississippi the most disgusting place to have a battle on the face of the earth?
That I don't recall. So that probably means no.
That was, the reason the Confederate Army left early was that they lost as many casualties to plain old swamp fevers as they had at the Battle of of Shiloh a little while before. And
yes,
it also, and they all had diarrhea to the point that they just, they talked about the evacuation of Corinth in a very ironic way.
So my memory of it, it was a long time ago, is that to me it looked like a horrible place to hide out, but that was sort of what protected them in a sense, because who the hell would
go? No one's going to go.
Yes,
escaping slaves and impoverished.
But the movie didn't seem to focus on like how physically horrible that environment was.
I'm thinking about the town of Corinth, the swamp. Okay.
No.
I know from Eileen's review that they airbrushed the swamp, but
yes.
You got to do Corinth as an absolute
hellhole.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, the plus side is it's such a great narrative that you can't entirely botch. It's based on a true account of a guy named Newton Knight, who basically declares, his own state in Mississippi that he then has to defend, which is pro-union, anti-slavery and everything else in Mississippi. So that means he's living, basically sitting on, his front step with a shotgun, and his son's in the woods with guns, and they're just armed to the teeth, and they're having to fight off all comers until he for the rest of his life, and he lives to be, I don't know, 88 or something.
It's just so amazing.
Oh, he's an amazing guy.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. So, read the book for sure.
The book is not bad at all. I didn't see the movie, but the book is really quite good. Mm-hmm. And the incident, maybe the climax of Knight's career, is when he kicks in the door of a tavern in Ellisville, the local town, and blasts this Confederate Major Macklemore, who's in charge of hunting down deserters. Very effective guerrilla action. And the strangest thing about that is I started looking into this. I was researching it for a while. That incident became a song among anti-Confederate Mississippi folk music fans. I can't remember the guy's name, but one that has a song, and Major Macklemore's gone. Like, that's the chorus, like, kaboom.
Wow. Another thing that you rarely see is it really tries to tackle Reconstruction and how dire it is, and how very quickly all hopes and dreams of a more just and equitable South just get stomped to death. So that's rare to see, not in the terms Gone with the Windish terms or Birth of a Nation terms that you usually see, which is the Yankee carpetbagger who's rapacious, who's coming to make money off the ruins, who arm in arm with a freed black slave who's always portrayed in the most insulting possible terms. That's the way you'll see most of the time, and this actually tries to counter that. So that's one.
So funny
plus.
That even Mississippi had its pro-union breakaway or anti-Confederacy, let's say breakaway regions like North Carolina did. But of course, the one state that didn't have any of that at all was South Carolina, which is the hero of Birth of a Nation, or the setting for Birth
of
a
course,
Nation, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is another
the only Confederate state
it.
That did not have a unit fighting in the Union Army, which is pretty striking. I just want to mention one last movie that I don't think a lot of people have seen. It's called The Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid, and it includes an amazing cast. It's also from that odd hippies doing Civil War thing. Robert Duvall as Jesse James, who's pure evil, is very good. And I think Cliff Robertson as Cole Younger.
What's it called again?
Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid. Very, very strange, but I remember it fondly.
Early 70s. Okay. I think this might have been on your list, is it, Eileen?
No, and back
it's
to
not.
My
have
shame, John
it?
Has been telling me to watch this damn thing for decades, and I still haven't watched it, but it would be a great companion piece with The Beguiled. That would be great.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So, you've given a few movies. I don't know if there's anything else. I mean, we've talked about,
Well, maybe one last recommendation. We know John says Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid. Okay.
Yes.
Is there one last one? I don't even know off mine. I think I might have said all mine.
there's still Civil War movies yet to be made, is what it says to me.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. In fact, a lot of them. That's what's frustrating about the overall experience is I'm always reading, oh my God, they're going to do Harriet Tubman. Oh my God, they're going to do Ned. Oh my God. And getting really excited and then getting disappointed. So, you know, the movies in my head are certainly not appearing anywhere on screen.
Do you think the part of the problem is just it's expensive to do the big war scenes, or do you think they still have the same worries about, you know, constituencies, or is just,
well, as we've been saying, it seems like that's kind of loosening up, and it would, you know, just think the war scenes would be so fabulous that it's just like, why, if they're going to throw so much money at so much crap? I mean, I just saw Avatar and I wanted to put a gun to my head.
It's bad, huh? Oh, that's too bad.
I just hated it. But yeah, I don't know why there couldn't be a big epic on an anniversary year Civil War movie that can finally be pro-North and anti-slavery and do the battles and pick which battles, do Sherman, do Grant.
Yeah.
And really, yeah, that would be so fantastic. It's just a bafflement to me that it hasn't happened.
Saving Private and then somebody from the North or something, you know? And,
oh, God. Like,
why not? It should be done. You know?
I mean, we're a weird country, aren't we? Because, like, there's no American Revolution movies, apparently, unless Patriot.
That's the worst movie.
The worst movie ever.
I know. That's a good case for not making any more.
Exactly. If they're going to do that, they shouldn't. So there's just, that's hilarious. So weird, though.
I was rooting for the Brits in that one, if I remember right.
I know. Like,
yeah.
I wouldn't go that far, but yeah, I know what you mean.
I think it's the only time I have that. Yeah, I was genuinely rooting for the Brits.
Like, our Civil War movies are so odd. They're so odd and skewed, not just ideologically, but toward like home front stories and not famous battles.
I know.
And not the famous, you know, biographies you'd think. And it's just such an odd history that you think
D-Day
there's so
weren't
much material.
Shit compared to Gettysburg. There's Gettysburg, but like there's so many other battles too. I just, the whole Western campaign and D-Day, Schmee-Day. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. It's just all that material just sitting there. So,
All right. Well, we all agree on that.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've kept you very long, as John said, and we want to thank you again so much. Eileen Jones, check out her podcast and newsletter as well on Patreon. Film Suck. We'll post links to Film Suck, of course.
That's Film Suck, one word.
Film Suck, one word. read her excellent reviews. They're always fun to read. Almost always on Jacobin, if not always. And Eileen is the only reviewer, period, I can think of, let alone film reviewer or whatever, that can write about something that she likes, which is, I tell you, as a writer, it's very hard to write about something you like. Unless you focus on everyone around what you like that you hate. That's what I would do. It's like, okay, I like this thing. I'm going to write about everybody who ripped so-and-so off and who's bad and blah, blah, blah. Because I can't really write about what I like. But you have that talent to even be able to write about what you like the Coen brothers or whatever, you know, and make it fun and compelling to read. So every one of your reviews is great. So,
thank you, you guys. Mm-hmm. God, this has been delightful. I wish we could do this every day.
All right. Thanks
again,
Eileen.
Well, next time another Civil War movie comes out, we'll get you back.
Oh, let's do it. I would love it.
All right.
You hearing that, Hollywood? Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Get on.
Thanks, Eileen. Okay.
Thanks,
everyone.
You guys.
Have a good trip, John. Okay.
Okay, thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.